This is Free Speech Radio News for Thursday, June 18th, 2009. From Bogota, Colombia, I'm Manuel Rueda. In Washington, D.C., lawmakers wrangle over the cost of a healthcare reform bill, while the U.S. Treasury Secretary defends a new financial regulatory system. A new study in Argentina claims a Monsanto herbicide is linked to birth defects. And we go to Zimbabwe, where activists are still struggling to obtain political freedoms. All these stories and more after this news.
I'm Jess Burns with headlines for Free Speech Radio News. More than 100 Romanians have fled their homes in Belfast after a string of racist attacks. The cases of racially charged violence in Northern Ireland has risen over the past decade, and another Romanian home was vandalized just last night. Naomi Fowler reports.
Although only around 1,000 Romanians live in Northern Ireland, they tend to be the most disadvantaged and the most visibly different. Following multiple acts of vandalism and violence, more than 100 Romanians now say they're too afraid to go back to their houses. Some want to leave Northern Ireland altogether. About 20 families and their young children are now in protective accommodation in an undisclosed location. Dr. Robin Wilson lives in the area and studies community relations. He believes it's an unintended consequence of the peace process there.
It's not a surprise, and the underlying culture of intolerance in Northern Ireland has really not been changed at all by the peace process, and no serious attempt was made to change it. In fact, in many regards, what happened was some of the most intolerant political figures in Northern Ireland were placed in positions of real authority as a result.
Campaigners say a coherent strategy for race relations is a low priority, and the number of prosecutions for hate crimes is low. Naomi Fowler, FSRN, London.
At least 25 people are dead following a blast from a suicide car bomb in western Somalia. The country's internal security minister died in the attack. The Somali president is blaming Al-Qaeda. So far, no one has claimed responsibility. Pakistan's army, with the help of a U.S. drone, has launched an attack on a Pakistan Tariq Taliban command center in South Waziristan. From Pakistan, FSRN's Gabe Matthews has more.
Two top Taliban commanders, Bait Ullah Massoud and Mullah Nazir, operate from South Waziristan, a region along Pakistan's southern border with Afghanistan. Early Thursday, a suspected U.S. drone attack killed 12 when they hit Mullah Nazir's hideout. Journalists in South Waziristan fear the number of dead will rise as the rubble is cleared. No civilians have been reported among the dead. Bait Ullah and Mullah Nazir have recently united forces. Bait Ullah claimed responsibility for several attacks in different parts of Pakistan. During the recent fighting, nearly 1,000 Pakistani families have left their homes in South Waziristan, and most of them now live in tents or with relatives. A refugee in the region told FSRN via phone that life is harsh for the displaced civilians living in the tents, and around 50 families have migrated to Afghanistan due to fear. Reading for Gabe Matthews, this is Nathan Moore, FSRN.
Today, West Bank residents hurled stones at Israeli police and government employees as they handed out demolition orders to Palestinian-owned homes in Jerusalem. FSRN's Ghassan Benoura reports.
Residents of Al-Bustan neighborhood succeeded in forcing government authorities out of their neighborhood, but only after the officials delivered 33 demolishing orders. Hatem Abdel Kader, the Minister of Jerusalem Affairs in the Palestinian government, said the demolition orders are politically motivated.
The high number of demolition orders indicates they are political. The objective is to force the Palestinians out and tip the demographic balance towards the settlers. 1,200 homes are currently set for demolition in Jerusalem.
According to Israel, the homes were built without the required building permits. A new Israeli law allows homes to be demolished or evicted without the government having to levy formal charges or get a conviction. Earlier this year, the owners of all 88 homes in Al-Bustan neighborhood received demolishing orders. Those orders were delayed when the owners appealed to court. Ghassan Bannoura, FSRN, Bethlehem.
14 activists have been arrested during a nonviolent action at a mountaintop removal coal mining site in the Coal River Valley of West Virginia. Early Thursday morning, the group unfurled two giant banners on the property, one on the ground reading "Stop Mountaintop Removal, Clean Energy Now." Activists suspended the other from a 150-foot-high piece of machinery. The group says they are responding to a recent Obama administration decision to reform instead of abolish mountaintop removal mining. The U.S. Supreme Court has ruled that prisoners do not have the constitutional right to get DNA testing in order to try to prove their innocence. The conservative bloc voted 5-4, overturning a circuit court ruling upholding an Alaska man's right to obtain a DNA test. In dissent, Justice John Paul Stevens said the Supreme Court is blessing Alaska's arbitrary denial of evidence. Most states already have DNA laws on the books that would likely trump this latest decision. Just months after a judge ordered the W.R. Grace & Company to pay $250 million to help clean up the asbestos-riddled town of Libby, Montana, the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency, for the first time ever, has declared a community has a public health emergency. Because of asbestos contamination remaining from Grace & Company's vermiculite mine, the community's rate of respiratory disease and cancer is well above the national average. EPA Administrator Lisa Jackson.
It is a toxic legacy, the legacy of decades of mining operations.
In addition, the Department of Health and Human Services says it will provide grant funds for residents suffering from asbestos-related illnesses. And finally, the United States Senate has approved a non-binding resolution apologizing to African Americans for slavery and segregation. The vote was unanimous. And that's headlines for Free Speech Radio News. From Eugene, Oregon, I'm Jess Burns.
Today, Treasury Secretary Timothy Geithner, testifying before the Senate Banking Committee, fended off criticisms of President Obama's plan to reform the nation's financial oversight bodies. The plan comes after months of wrestling with lawmakers, regulators, and industry lobbyists, and it seeks to expand the authority of the Federal Reserve. FSRN's Matt Pearson reports.
Members of the Senate Banking Committee grilled Secretary Geithner about the ins and outs of the administration's regulatory plan, which was released Wednesday as an 85-page white paper. The primary aspect of the plan, to increase the regulatory authority of the Fed to police large companies, aroused bipartisan skepticism amongst the senators, such as Senator Richard Shelby from Alabama.
Secretary, the administration's proposal chooses to grant the Fed authority to regulate systemic risk because, quote, it has the most experience to regulate systemically significant institutions. I personally believe this represents a grossly inflated view of the Fed's expertise.
But Geithner says the Fed requires an expanded role in order to assess risk earlier and to act faster to resolve crises. He says a lack of authority is what allowed the recent economic crisis to deepen.
The Fed was left with no responsibility and no ability to contain those basic risks, and that's an important thing for us to change if we're going to build a stronger system.
He also defended the creation of two new government bodies that the plan proposes. One is a consumer protection agency, and the other is a federal regulatory body that he said would close up loopholes in federal regulation.
Regulators were ill-equipped to spot system-wide threats because each was assigned to protect the safety and soundness of individual institutions under their watch. None was assigned to look out for the broader system as a whole. That's why we propose establishing a Financial Services Oversight Council to bring together the heads of all the major federal financial regulatory agencies. And this council will help ensure that we fill gaps in the regulatory structure where they exist and where they emerge. It will improve coordination of policy and help us resolve disputes across agencies. And most importantly, it will have the power to gather information from any firm or market to help identify and help the underlying regulators respond to emerging risks.
Top economic officials in the Obama administration, including Geithner, have been negotiating with Congress, industry lobbyists, and federal regulators for months about the details of the plan. Now that it has been released, Senator Christopher Dodd and House Representative Barney Frank will oversee the committees in which the details of a regulatory bill will be hammered out. They have said that completed legislation will be on the president's desk by the end of 2009. Matt Pearson, Free Speech Radio News, Washington.
The Senate Health, Education, Labor, and Pension Committee, otherwise known as HELP, is currently reviewing a massive 600-page health reform bill. On day two of the discussions, committee members wrangled over the cost of the bill and what's known as defensive medicine. FSRN's Karen Miller has more.
For Republicans on the committee, the $1 trillion price tag of the health reform bill was key. Senator Jud Gregg of New Hampshire wanted to add an amendment that says a congressional budget office has to show proof that a measure will not cause more debt before it's moved on.
I just don't think that we should go forward on a wish and a prayer and anecdotal events. We ought to have an independent evaluation of whether these things are really going to save money, because, quite honestly, if they don't save money, we're in deep trouble. We're running up trillions of dollars of debt, and the debt is the threat.
Democratic senators gave the plan a thumbs down. Chris Dodd of Connecticut says making a decision on a measure is Congress's job.
If our criteria is exclusively whether or not the General Accounting Office or the Congressional Budget Office determines that they cost some money and they decide then to strike them from the bill, we basically relegated ourselves to nothing more than the proposer of ideas and relegated to an agency outside of the Congress to determine whether or not they include it or not. That, in my experience, is never something we've ever done before, but we've given an outside organization the ability like this to preclude something.
The senators on the committee voted down the amendment 13-10. In addition, Senator Orrin Hatch of Utah introduced an amendment that would limit the use of comparative effectiveness research in the bill. This is a practice of identifying the treatment options that are the most effective for a given condition. But Hatch says doctors should be able to practice medicine defensively with unlimited options.
If we go the way that we're talking about with comparative effectiveness, setting the standards for everybody in this country and for every individual, regardless of what that individual's individual needs are, then I think we're just opening up the door for a multi-plethora of frivolous lawsuits. I think you have to put safeguards in place to mitigate these litigations.
The committee again voted against the amendment. Senator Chris Dodd, filling in for Committee Chair Edward Kennedy, also tried at Republicans who kept on using the word ration in their statements to the committee.
It's said over and over again. I don't know of anyone on this committee that's for health rationing. It's used all the time, and it's offensive. We're not for health rationing.
That's right.
We're for driving down costs where we can to bend that curve to deliver accessible, quality, affordable health care. And the notion of frightening people by talking about rationing does not contribute to the debate.
Members of Congress wanted a bill on the floor by midsummer. But some say with new information released this week from the Congressional Budget Office on the $1 trillion cost of the bill, the progress may be even slower. Karen Miller, FSRN, Washington.
And now we go to Sudan. According to the United Nations, the Sudanese government's war against separate movements in Darfur has killed up to 300,000 people over the past 6 years, displacing over 2.7 million from their homes. The U.S. has applied economic sanctions on the African nation and has repeatedly accused the Sudanese government of committing genocide. But on Wednesday, President Obama's special envoy to Sudan indicated the government there is no longer coordinating a campaign of mass murder. Retired General Scott Gratian.
What we see is the remnants of genocide. What we see are the consequences of genocide, the results of genocide. We still have thousands of people living in camps as IDPs. We have women who are still afraid to go out and collect firewood. And we have children that are not having the benefits of growing up in their homeland, but are growing up in these camps.
Gratian said the level of violence now is mainly between rebel groups, the Sudanese government, and some violence between Chad and Sudan. But Gratian repeated that it doesn't appear there's a coordinated effort of mass killings, as there was between 2003 to 2006. He also mentioned plans for an international conference in D.C. to talk about a peace deal. And some Sudanese leaders are arriving in the U.S. next week. So what does this mean for the people in Darfur and for U.S. policy towards Sudan? We're on the line now with Alex Meixner, the Director of Policy and Government Relations for Save Darfur, a group that is pressuring the U.S. government to find a solution to the crisis in Sudan. Thanks for joining us, Alex.
Thank you for having me.
Your organization has been monitoring the human rights situation in Darfur. What's the situation like for people there right now?
Well, for most people in Darfur, it's still very, very difficult day to day. There are something about 2.5 million Darfurians living in camps throughout Darfur, another 1.5 million on top of that that are also dependent on humanitarian aid for their very survival. So it's very tense. It's there's not much security and there's not much guarantee of continued access to food, to water, to medicine. So life in Darfur continues to be difficult.
Now, I understand that Scott Gration, President Obama's special envoy to Sudan, says that while the situation is still difficult and there's fighting going on, he says that the government is no longer engaging in genocide. What's the significance of those remarks?
I don't think that the government of Sudan has in any way lessened its intent to destroy these tribes within Darfur. It's just changed its tactics. Instead of openly attacking villages, because there's not that many villages left to attack, frankly, it's changed to this this method of keeping people stuck in camps, refusing to make any progress on a peace agreement which could allow them to return home. I think it's really a second stage in genocide, and what General Gration said was we're dealing with the remnants, the after effects of essentially the first stage of genocide, the violent burning and looting of villages.
Gration, the special envoy, he's called on the government, or he's proposing to ease sanctions on Sudan. What do you make of that proposal?
Well, again, from my understanding, General Gration isn't proposing to ease sanctions with no restrictions, and certainly easing sanctions, without getting anything in return is something we as Save Darfur would, wholeheartedly oppose, and we would expect and frankly demand that President Obama would put a stop to and that Congress would put a stop to. The question really right now is how are we going to get out of the current situation where, it's been, literally about 6 years that this genocide has been occurring. There still are these millions of people that are in these camps. We have to figure out a way to get them home. The idea is to create enough pressures upon the Sudanese government, combined with a few incentives, that they will be willing to change their policies, reverse their policies, perhaps change their leadership within the Sudanese government, and move to a second stage where they are willing to send people home and they're willing to sign a peace agreement with the rebels that will allow life in Darfur to get back to normal.
What sort of leverage does the U.S. government have over Sudan? I mean, it's usually complicated to change what another country does within their borders. So what sort of leverage do you think is available?
The U.S. has just about every economic sanction you can put on another country on the books right now for Sudan. The U.S. at this point, needs to search and find additional leverage on the Sudanese government. And one of the key ways they can do that is by getting other countries on board. With President Bush, the countries that do have leverage over Sudan, and these tend to be African countries, Arab countries, China, the countries that deal most closely with the Sudanese regime, they were unwilling, in large part, to go along with anything President Bush wanted them to do. It's our great hope that President Obama, with his popularity both in the U.S. and more to the point overseas, will be able to coordinate these countries a bit better, will be able to use his influence, use his popularity to get some of these African and Arab countries and China to increase their own pressures of the Sudanese government.
Alex, well, thanks for joining us. Would you like to add anything else?
One of the things we've seen with this administration is that there are a lot of things that are at or near the top of their agenda. It's going to take American citizens calling them, writing them, standing in the streets and yelling at them to ensure that Darfur and Sudan stay at the top of their agenda.
That was Alex Meixner from Save Darfur. For more information on Darfur, you can visit their website, www.savedarfur.org. You're listening to FSRN. For archives, documentaries, and specials, you can visit our website, fsrn.org. Amnesty International Secretary General Irene Khan has described the human rights situation in Zimbabwe as precarious. Khan spoke today after meeting government and civil rights groups in a week-long visit to the southern African country. Her report comes as police arrest peaceful demonstrators who were commemorating World Refugee Day. Davison Makanga reports.
Khan said her mission has revealed that there is little commitment by the government to implement the coalition accord signed last September by political rivals, ZANU-PF and the Movement for Democratic Change. She said systematic political violence is still rife in the country.
Human rights defenders, journalists, and lawyers continue to be intimidated, harassed, threatened, detained, and charged, often for malicious prosecution.
Khan says that the gravity of the situation in Zimbabwe requires a unified response.
We call on the international community, both African governments as well as Western ones, to work together to develop a common human rights strategy for Zimbabwe.
Ironically, as to confirm Khan's assessment, Harare police violently disbanded a peaceful march by women who were commemorating World Refugee Day. Women of Zimbabwe Arise coordinator Jane Williams says the arrest of members of her organization Thursday is evidence that the coalition government has done little to guarantee civil liberties and freedom of expression.
Don't have the social justice promised to us in the GPA, promised in many different forums. Until we get it and until our children are able to be educated, we'll be on the streets.
Meanwhile, Minister of State in the Prime Minister's office, Gordon Moyo, says resistance from some officials aligned to President Robert Mugabe is surmountable.
We take these elements like those spoilers in any transitional arrangement, but they are not going to dissuade us or sidetrack us from the goal that we have set ourselves to achieve.
The government of Zimbabwe launched a national healing department that is set to roll out reconciliation programs around the country. However, many survivors of past election violence demand that perpetrators be prosecuted. Davison Makanga, Free Speech Radio News.
New research released by Argentina's top medical school has found that a chemical used in soy farming could be harmful to human health. The study has alarmed policymakers in the South American nation, which is one of the world's largest producers of soybeans. FSRN's Mary Trigona reports from Buenos Aires.
An herbicide used in growing Roundup Ready seeds, called glyphosate, has come under fire. A study released last month reports that glyphosate, previously patented under the name Roundup, causes birth defects when applied in doses much lower than what is commonly used in soy fields. The study was directed by a leading embryologist, Dr. Andres Carrasco, a professor and researcher at the University of Buenos Aires. In his office in the nation's top medical school, Dr. Carrasco pulls out photos of birth defects in the embryos of amphibians exposed to glyphosate. The embryos in the photos have visible defects, one eye the size of the head, spinal cord deformations, and kidneys that are not fully developed.
We injected embryo cells with glyphosate in a solution much lower, very low, 1,000 times diluted from what they use on the soy fields. What we see are clear alterations, defects in the face. You can see in the embryos on the side of the cell that was injected, defects in the eye and defects in the cartilage.
Glyphosate is the top-selling herbicide in the world and is widely used on soy crops in Argentina. It's part of a technological package of the Roundup Ready seed, marketed by Monsanto. The study has alarmed policymakers, so much so that Dr. Carrasco has received anonymous threats, and many in the agribusiness industry say his study has little scientific basis. Industry leader Monsanto wouldn't talk to FSRN for this story, but in a press release on their website, the company says that glyphosate is safe. Guillermo Cal is the executive director of CASAFE, Argentina's Association of Agrochemical Companies, which members include Monsanto, Dow AgroSciences, DuPont, and Bayer Crop Science. Cal dismissed the recent study conducted at the University of Buenos Aires.
There are hundreds of articles made about the impact of glyphosate in amphibians, And none of these articles have shown these disastrous effects that Dr. Carrasco is mentioning. I have the suspicion that this is headlines and probably politically motivated article.
When I asked who conducted these studies reporting the safety of glyphosate, Carl responded,
"The developing companies. These companies are the ones that have to finance all the studies because they have to have all those proofs of innocuous products developed prior to launching the product to the market."
Since Argentina's soybean boom in the late 90s, clinical studies have been conducted in communities with high cancer and birth defect rates, even natal mortality. In a small town bordering soy farms in the province of Córdoba, the mothers of Ituzaingó group formed in response to sudden increases in cancer rates. Sofía Gatica is an activist with the mothers.
Here in the neighborhood, we have 5,000 residents. In 2001, we reported almost 200 cases of cancer. Today, we report that we have more than 300 patients with cancer and more than double the amount of cases unregistered.
Gatica suffered the death of her newborn baby, born with a malformed kidney, and her 14-year-old daughter is currently undergoing treatment for toxicity in the blood. She describes other defects that have occurred locally.
We have had children born with only two thumbs. We have children with malformed kidneys. We have had children born without an anus, malformations in the intestines. We have people who are sick. We can prove that agrochemicals have harmed us. We can prove this with studies and with whatever is left of our children.
Monoculture soy is grown on more than 42 million acres of fields sprayed with more than 44 million gallons of glyphosate annually. Argentina's Secretary of Agriculture refused FSRN's formal request for an interview, citing that the secretary is, quote, unwilling to talk about the use and regulation of agrochemicals in Argentina's soy industry. Dr. Carrasco says that the study should serve as a red light warning for policymakers evaluating regulations for glyphosate, which has been categorized as a level 4 toxin, the lowest level possible for agrochemicals.
In science and medicine, when you suspect that something dangerous is occurring, you need to implement the principle called precaution. I need to take precautions. I can't ignore the problem. I can't wait until there are a lot of deaths to intervene.
Since the study was released in April, a group of environmental lawyers have petitioned the Supreme Court to ban the use of the herbicide. Marie Trigona, FSRN, Buenos Aires.
You've been listening to Free Speech Radio News. Our newscast is supported by Pacifica Radio, community radio affiliate stations, and listener supporters. We podcast at www.fsrn.org. That's fsrn.org. You can email us your feedback, questions, and story ideas to comments@fsrn.org. Today's newscast was produced by Catherine Comp and Vinod K. Joes, headlines editor Jess Burns, and the technical production team at KPFA in Berkeley, Puck Lowe and Rose Katapchi. From Bogota, Colombia, I'm Manuel Rueda.